Welcome.
Benvenuti.
Ehlen wa sahlan.
Willkommen.
Ekhabo.
Kushanda dit.
Atopei no runia. Here on Earth.
Here on Earth.
Here on Earth.
Kalos orisete sto Here on Earth.
Welcome to Here on Earth.
وعزيزه يعني كانت مدلله بالبيت.
She was so dear to us. She was beautiful, innocent. I had taught her to read and write. She was our finest girl.
3 weeks ago, 16-year-old Fatima was abducted from her family's house in West Baghdad. The unidentified kidnappers left a note demanding her brother quit the police or Fatima would be raped and killed. He did as they demanded. Fatima was returned, but not spared.
She knew the customs, but I don't think she expected we would kill her. She was crying. I saw in her eyes that she thought we would take her in our arms and say, "Thank God you were safe." But she got bullets instead.
NPR correspondent Anne Garrels filed that report for All Things Considered in December of 2005. According to my guest this hour, Zainab Salabi, what happens to women is often a clear indicator of what is to come for the rest of society. In Iraq, women like Fatima were the first to be kidnapped after the fall of Saddam Hussein. In Afghanistan, the oppressive rule of the Taliban began when women were forced under the burqa. In Rwanda, early signs of the genocide to come were first heard on hate radio when the Hutu militia suggested ways in which Tutsi women should be raped. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. This hour, the other side of war. Today, it is most often women in post-orphan zones the world over who are left to do the mopping up. They are busy caring for orphans, planting gardens, starting businesses, becoming community organizers, rebuilding their ravaged homelands, their families, their lives. If we are to understand war fully, says Zainab Salabi, we need to understand not only what happens on the front lines, but what happens on the back lines as well, where women are in charge of keeping life going. How can we help them do just that? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Again, that's 1-800-642-1234. What kind of inspiration do you derive from the stories of women who are rebuilding their lives and their communities in post-conflict zones? If you're listening to us online, you can send your emails to us. Our address is hereonearth@wpr.org. Zainab Salabi is the founder and CEO of Women for Women International. It's a nonprofit organization that helps women survivors of wars and civil strife gain necessary skills and resources to rebuild their lives. She received the 2005 Human Security Award presented by the University of California, Irvine. She was also honored with the 2005 Forbes Trailblazer Award. Time magazine named her Innovator of the Month in March of 2005 for her pioneering work as philanthropist. In 2004, she was named as Communicator of the Year from Alverno College. The Other Side of War is actually her second book, her first, Between Two Worlds, Escape from Tyranny, Growing Up in the Shadow of Saddam, is a memoir detailing her life growing up in Iraq. Zainab Salabi, it's an honor to welcome you to Here on Earth.
Thank you very much. It's my honor to be with you. Thank you.
I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
It's Zainab Salabi, but it's a good try.
Zainab.
Yes.
Zainab Salabi.
Yes.
That's much better. Thank you.
Not at all.
I understand that when you were only 9 years old growing up in Iraq, you told your mother that one day you would help women around the world. What was going on in your country then that would prompt such a sentiment from one so young?
Well, growing up in a totalitarian country in Iraq, We could never talk about any issues. You could not talk about injustice. As any Iraqi, you had to sort of hide any political thinking that you had, you may have. But the only way that my mother penetrated that silence that we all had to survive, because the simplest things, you could be telling a simple, innocent joke about Saddam and that would put you in prison. You could make a very simple, innocent comment about any of his family and that could put you in prison. And so we were all afraid, constantly afraid of expressing ourselves. But in my opinion, my mother penetrated that silence by talking about violence against women. And then that was a safe discussion to have because it was about women. And so I grew up with my mother, was very adamant telling me about what women go through, from domestic violence to rape to their silence to their being second-class citizens. I grew up with her holding me very strongly and says, never let anybody talk with you the wrong way or touch you the wrong way. She refused to teach me how to cook or clean because she said no man should expect you to know that just because you are a woman. And she talked through the narratives of her own mother and her own grandmothers and the women around her, her friends, her aunts, her sisters, and that's how that silence was broken. It was a safe subject. But as a result, also I had a very early awareness that I need to, in my interest in women and in my interest in their silence, and that I need to help them. And that was early on, and I think that the biggest issue, the turning point in my life when my mother did not laugh at me when I said I want to do that, when she looked at me and said, you can do it. And it's always an idea that stuck in my head and didn't get to live it until I was 23 years old when I started Women for Women International.
And when you first started Women for Women International, people laughed at you as well.
Absolutely. First of all, I was 23 years old. I had no work experience, very limited one. I was a new immigrant in the United States, recently married. I had no money whatsoever. And a lot of my surroundings at that time were saying, what are you doing? Well, you know, you need to go and work and make money and build a home and all of these things. For the longest time, there were people who were laughing, but there were people who said, oh my God, we want to join you in this effort. We too are feeling frustrated at what's happening in Bosnia. And in Bosnia, the rape camps in Bosnia and the concentration camps in Bosnia was the reason why I started Women for Women International. It was happening in the 90s. Women were given numbers in these rape camps, and when their numbers were called, they had to go to another room and get gang raped for a period from anywhere from 1 month to 9 months. And so there were lots of women who were there and said, we want to join you. We really want to reach out to them. We are feeling so frustrated that we cannot do. And there were a few of people around me that they were saying, you're wasting your time and not believing that someone can make a difference. Mm. Now, over the years, what started as a very simple effort, it turned into helping 93,000 women, reaching out directly to 500,000 family members and impacting 5.3 million community members. And now people start laughing. But more than anything, I really believe that each one of us can make a difference in this, what sometimes feels like a very frustrating world. But rather than sitting on the margins and saying we can't make a difference, I really believe we can make a difference.
What took you to the rape camps to begin with?
What took me to the rape camps? I grew up in war, so what really impacted me to a great extent is the fact that I grew up in the Iran-Iraq war. I grew up in Iraq. War very much defined my outlook on life. War for me was about not only what I call the frontline discussion that is discussed often in our daily newspapers here, which is the bullets and the tanks and the troops, but war for me was really about the backline discussion and what it was about life in war. War for me was my family discussing whether we should sleep all in the same room so if a missile drops on our home, we will all die together, or whether we should sleep in our respective rooms and just take a risk, and maybe we'll just half of the family will die, because lots happened like that during the war. And war for me, whether it was my mom playing puppet shows during a siren on the candle light so she would not make us afraid. or discussing what does it mean that the friend of my 9-year-old brother was killed because a missile landed on their home. So war for me was the very intimate issues, the fear, the discussions about death from a very young age. And when I came to the States, I came just 1 month before the Iraq invaded Kuwait and thus the first Gulf War. And again, war for me was, what will happen to my family? Are they alive? Are they dead? Are they eating? Are they having heat? It was the intimate issues that no one was talking about at the time, and I really feel not many people are still not talking about it now as we talk Iraq or we talk about Afghanistan or any other war for that matter. So when I came to the United States, it was my first time really to learn about other wars that were happening beside Iraq. Growing up in Iraq, it was also illegal for us to own or read newspapers or magazines like Time Magazine or Newsweek. We would actually go to prison if we are caught with these magazines. And so you learn to shut your mind off. You learn not to think because you're afraid in case you slip. My personal case was that much more dangerous because my father was Saddam Hussein's pilot, and we knew Saddam Hussein. We saw him every single weekend, and I always say being close to the devil meant that we were that much closer to danger. It did not mean that we were safe from danger. And so when I came to the States, it was my first time to learn about other wars and about other that was happening around the world. And that was, in that time, was Bosnia. And I felt I knew what it means to be in a war. I knew what it feels like. I knew that feeling of isolation, that feeling that the world has forgotten about you and they don't know you exist. And so it wasn't only the rape camps. It was the fact that people were going through wars and there was no voice coming out of them. There was only a discussion of what we thought of them, but never from out of them. And that's what triggered the thinking that we need to reach out to these women. We need to reach out in tangible ways to help them the way they want to be helped and not the way we want to help them.
So you just took yourself off to Bosnia? You were just newly married at that point.
I was newly married, and my husband and I went to Croatia. Actually, Bosnia was completely besieged, and we could not enter it. It took us about a few more months to be able to enter it. And the first day we went to Croatia, we met with a woman who her name is Aisha, and she had been in a rape camp for 9 months, and she was released when she was 8 months pregnant. She was released in a prisoner's exchange. I never will forget the day I met Aisha. She was shaking. She talked about the rape camp. She talked about how she was gang raped on a daily basis. She talked about how she delivered her baby in refugee camps, and then she lost the baby. She could not find where her husband is, where her two children were. She was completely, completely devastated. And that was the moment in which I realized that I will change my life. I will stop whatever I was doing and just focus all my life on helping women like Aisha. It's hard to go back to our daily lives, in my opinion, and this is, I'm privileged to, I feel, in many ways, to still work with women who survived wars, who have been my best teachers in putting perspective about our lives in here, about my own life, the privileges that we have, and how we take so many things for granted so often.
We're talking this hour with Zainab Salbi. She is the founder and CEO of Women for Women International, an organization that helps women survivors of wars rebuild their lives and their communities. She has documented the work of women for women in a wonderful book. It's a National Geographic book called The Other Side of War, Women's Stories of Survival and Hope. We'll hear some of them right after this announcement. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is hereonearth@wpr.org.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Physicians Plus Insurance Corporation, owned by Meritor Health Services and local doctors, and committed to improving the health of the community by encouraging kids to get out and get active. Online at healthychoicesbigrewards.com.
I'm Jean Faraca. HereOnEarth.org is the perfect companion to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. Learn more about our guests, topics, and the music we feature. You can subscribe to our podcast, post a message, and interact with other listeners. Log on to HereOnEarth.org and join us live Monday through Friday at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Sprint Print, serving Dane County businesses with full-color, offset, digital, and variable data printing. Sprint Print, located in Madison and on the web at sprintprint.com.
I am responsible for the household. I supervise my children when they sit and read their homework. When they ask me to buy certain things, I tell them I don't have money for that. They say it is not their fault their father is in prison. When the children all go to bed, I feel lonely. A woman feels a great vacuum when her husband is not there with her.
That's Zakia, whose husband is in prison because of conflict in Herzegovina, I believe. She made her comments to the Red Cross in the context of their Women Facing War PSA campaign. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. I'm Jean Faraca. This hour, The Other Side of War with Zainab Salbi, who has documented the lives of women like Zakia in post-conflict zones all around the world. Zainab, can you tell us how Zakia represents the experience of thousands of women like her?
Well, actually, Zakia reminds me of a woman I also in Bosnia and Herzegovina I met, and her name was Zainaba. And when I first met her, her husband was in a concentration camp for 2 years, and he was released in prisoner's exchange, and he was completely immobile at that time. And she was saying that she really, really wanted not only charity, she really wanted help to help her rebuild her life. And because her fear, she wanted to be a good mother, her fear that by not being able to provide to her children the food that they wanted or the jeans that they wanted or the shirt that they wanted, that her son, particularly she had a teenage son, that would be a thief. And she said, and that would fail him as a mother for not being able to provide. And it takes me back to how we actually help people, because often we distribute food and clothes and all of these things, which is all needed at a certain point. But we really ask, and we need to ask more, what do they need? What do they need? That dignity that any refugee has, everybody has, rather, but we that want to keep intact. As someone who survived war, again, using my own personal experience, no matter how much you had before or how much you don't have, and war takes away everything from you and destroys it. And you try to keep stronghold of your dignity. You want to be able to carry yourself with integrity. And that sometimes entails how we can help them. And so one of the things that Women for Women International does is actually connect women. We have an appeal to women all over the world to sponsor one woman at a time who is a survivor of war by sending her $27 a month along with a letter to start communication link between the two women. Because like Zakia said, she wants to have that ability to provide to her children, and that's partially what the money is used for. We immediately group the women, 20 women at a time, create a group, a woman's circle in which women can create a support network for them for war. One of the consequences of war we don't talk about is the loss of trust and support system. You no longer have your friend or your neighbor or your cousin or whatever that you can call in a dark day and say, I need help. You lose, the social fabric of the society is destroyed in war. And one of the things that we try to do with Women for Women is regroup it, restart it by creating the women's circles of 20 women at a time. Another consequence, I'm sorry, another consequence of war is the loss of people start believing there is such a thing as human rights and women's rights. A Bosnian woman said, I always believed in women's rights and human rights, but where was the world when my rights were violated? Mm-hmm. And that letter that we create, that connection between the American woman and the Bosnian woman or the Congolese woman or the Afghan woman, saying, I am here for you. I'm acknowledging you.
How do you deal with the language barrier?
We have local staff in all of the countries that we deal with. They are all 100% of our staff are local, actually, and they are translate. They are the ones who are translating the letters. We also teach the women, though, besides giving them the letters and the money, we teach them about women's rights and women's role in the economy, society, politics, and health. We also teach them vocational skills and business skills that can help them get jobs. Mm-hmm. And this is a one-year program where at the end of the year, with intensive training, we help them get jobs. But we also believe that in order to stand on your feet and rebuild your confidence and your self-esteem that the war has destroyed, you also need to know the value of your contribution in the society. Now,
one of the women that you interviewed, I think, said very eloquently, war took I out of me.
I my mother, who grew up, I mean, again, in Iraq, would always tell me that the war is taking the I in me. You are stripped away from any, independence and privacy. We often, when we deal with refugees, they're often in tents, and everybody with any capacity goes and open the tents and interview them or do whatever without a respect for privacy or space. You're totally stripped away from your private
space. Yes, I remember you described how in one of the refugee camps, the women who had been raped were sort of cordoned off in one place with a big sign over the tent that said, rape victims here.
Absolutely. I've seen it in many countries. I've seen it in Bosnia, actually, when it happened. I've seen it in Kosovo when it happens. It's a gate, again, you know, and some of these times, some of them are maybe not a vicious intention as much as perhaps a non-sensitive intention. And how do we actually respect the integrity of the refugees and of women survivors of wars?
Yeah.
And how to be sensitive to the fact that 80% of the world refugees are women and children. But not 80% of the services provided to them tailored to the fact that they are women and children, whether in the food that they eat or in the structure of the camps or in the fact that we isolate them and say rape victims so anybody can go and interview them.
Yes, and you make the point that when men are injured in war, they are heroes. When women are raped, they are cast aside and shamed.
Absolutely. We need to understand, absolutely, because women are targeted in a very direct way in war. As a matter of fact, 90% of modern war's casualties are civilians compared to the fact that before it was military or soldiers. And 75% of that are women and children. And women are targeted in wars in very organized ways, and particularly in rape that happens across the borders and all over the wars, and you name it. Mm-hmm. And for many ways, I mean, I think, and for many reasons, I don't believe rape in war is actually random. I believe it is organized.
Oh, very deliberate. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We learned that from Bosnia. Zainab, we have a caller who wants to join in. He is Stefano in Sheboygan, and we have open lines for other voices who will hopefully enter the conversation. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Stefano, thank you for your call. Go ahead.
Welcome. I fear I'm in a point where I may lose my coverage, but I'm enjoying the show, and I just wanted to mention, I'm thinking historically, and I think this may be a parallel point. I'm not sure if it applies directly to what you're discussing, but I find it interesting that we're talking about how women are treated in war, and it's horrific what we're hearing. And the point I want to make is that wars are often fought, and wars are never beautiful. The war in Iraq is certainly an ugly thing. But what I'm feeling is that what perhaps the areas where women are being dominated and treated like this are areas where democracy does not exist. Now, I believe that to some degree, if what hopefully maybe perhaps can and will happen in the Middle East is both a political enlightenment along with a religious reformation. And I'm not necessarily saying it's correct to impose it in any certain way, but perhaps that is what we need, and that is women through wars. And if you look at England's history and the Enlightenment, and you look at, you know, the religious reformation, when women are allowed to have a voice and allowed to participate in society, it sure seems to be a much better place.
Okay, thank you, Stefano. Considering that you yourself grew up in Iraq, I wonder why it is that you haven't targeted the relief efforts that you have so successfully that have so successfully brought sustenance to women in places like Congo and Rwanda and so forth. What about the women of Iraq?
Oh, Women for Women International does work in Iraq, and we expanded our efforts there since 2003. And actually, we are one of the very few international NGOs who are still operating in Iraq and working with 1,000 women there. It is the most dangerous place to operate in. But every time we talk to the women who are staff members, as well as the women who are participants in our program, They say this is our resistance. The resistance is by staying alive, keeping our kids going to school, trying to get jobs to survive. And every time I talk to our Iraqi staff on a weekly basis, and they say, trust us, we are the glue to the society. Mm-hmm. The women at this point are the glue to the society in Iraq. But no one is talking about, well, what do the women think about how to stabilize Iraq? And in many ways, it's not only about Iraq. In many ways, I really believe women are bellwether for the society. And rather than looking at women's issues as a marginal issue, you know, violence, or rather than saying, oh, violence always happens in war against women, we really need to look at studying at what's happening to women as an indicator to the direction of the society. Violence often starts through women, and progress often starts with women. And if we are to learn anything from countries like Afghanistan, where the Taliban started their violence against women in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. And eventually that violence spread to everyone in the country. Eventually it spread in the States, and I think everyone is paying price for that violence.
Actually, what we've heard is that women were really better off under Saddam Hussein, that because he was the head of a deliberately secular state, that women had positions in society, that they were in much, much better off, for example, than women under the Taliban in Afghanistan. But you would be the best person to respond to that.
Well, first of all, I think it's wrong to compare Iraq and Afghanistan. They are apples and oranges. It's like comparing France to America. It has nothing to do with
let's just compare apples to apples. What about women under Saddam Hussein and women under Maliki?
They are both bad. One of the things, as an Iraqi, that I think is the most unfair question is whether we prefer life under Saddam or whether we prefer life right now. And they are both bad. And no one should be asked which bad you prefer. Under Saddam, violence was a vertical violence. Yes, as women, we had personal freedom in terms of working and going to universities and all of that. But in the same time, the violence against women was so organized in Saddam's time that women were raped systematically by the government. The atrocities committers were the government. Mm-hmm. And right now what we have, what I call horizontal violence, in which everyone is vulnerable. Everyone is committing that violence. You never know where it's going to hit you from. Mm-hmm. Before, when we were in universities in Iraq, when Saddam's son would walk into the university, we all would escape so he would not see us, because if he sees someone and he likes her, he could rape her. Now, you're afraid to walk there. You're afraid to drive. You're afraid to do all of these things. And so they're both bad. Which do I rather live in, one or the other? They are both bad. And as Iraqis, we should, and as individuals, we should ask for a different future that does not entail the past or the present in Iraq. And if I am to say about Iraq, then I would say we really need to pay attention to what's happening to women as part of the national discussion on Iraq. Mm. I personally know 20 women who are educated, who are outspoken, who are working women who have been assassinated. They all have the same profile. They all have the same characteristics. Women hair salons are being targeted for bombing, and women college students are being targeted for assassinations and kidnapping. It is, and if we are to use security codes, code red. We've got to understand that what's happening to women is not only against women, it's an indicator to the direction of the society. How do we learn from that? I mean, because I really believe that strong women lead to strong nations, and we've got to get women at the negotiating tables and hear what they have to say of how to...
Yes, but the women were elected to the new parliament in Iraq, and they were assassinated subsequently.
Yes, and that's part of their resistance, and those who are still there are refusing to give up their post, regardless of their politics. Some of their politics are very conservative, and some of them are not, but they are, I take my hats off for them, to be frank, you know. They're saying, we cannot retreat. Mm. We cannot retreat after one attempt or two attempts. This is our resistance. This is our resilience.
We have Carl joining us from Milwaukee. Excuse me. We have Carl joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Carl.
Hi, I was actually, my question correlates pretty well to what you were just talking about. I was wondering if you see the U.S. intervention as being, I guess, providing significant change in terms of the quality of life towards women. Do you see any negatives as the U.S. Continues its intervention in Iraq? And also, if you feel administration policy is, the original policy was to, get rid of the oppression and the oppressive government in Iraq. So I was wondering if you feel that that's actually the main goal of what's going on. Because, I don't know, I'm thousands of miles away from here. It's hard to see noticeable change, but I guess a more in-depth.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Carl. We understand.
I'll answer by quoting you an Iraqi man, actually, that I interviewed right after the war in Iraq, in July of 2003. And he said, America came to someone who has been in a coma for 35 years. And the first thing that you ask someone who just woke up from a coma is not what kind of democracy you want or who do you want to vote for. It is what do you want to eat and what do you want to drink. And I think this actually speaks about a big disconnect between the discussions in here and between the discussions not only in Iraq, frankly, but in Afghanistan and in Congo and in Sudan and in Bosnia and in different countries, that we cannot talk about democracies and elections in a vacuum. Mm. And they are not the secret code for success also. I disagree with the first caller in terms of saying that's what will lead. We really need to deliver tangibles. People measure the peace. People judge peace by the fact that my life will improve. But we can't talk about peace only by having election. We have to talk about peace of how do we create jobs and how do we create good schools and good health systems and all of that, because that's how people are measuring the definition of peace. And we've got to deliver these services in very tangible ways. And when we are not delivering it, then the very group we are fighting, which is extremism, is delivering it in very tangible ways. Many religious extremists deliver food, deliver clothes, deliver schooling, do all kinds of things, and they take the hearts and minds of people. And if we are to talk about how do we build stabilities, democracies, liberations for women, all of these things, we need to also we need to make the economic discussion and the building of the infrastructure and the building of the schools and the hospitals and the restoring of the electricity and the giving of a decent lifestyle for the people as a priority in our discussion of how do we stabilize not only Iraq, but any country for that matter.
We're talking with Zainab Salbi. She's the president and CEO of Women for Women International, an organization that helps women survivors of wars to rebuild their lives and their communities. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. We have open lines, 1-800-642-1234. Do you think we have unrealistic expectations about what to expect from war-devastated countries like Afghanistan and Iraq? And should we be concentrating, as our guest suggests, on offering food and clean water and electricity and schools instead? 1-800-642-1234. Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders is the interactive radio show that features voices from all over the world. How about yours? The program airs live weekday afternoons at 3 Central Time, and podcast listeners can stream the show at our website, hereonearth.org. To join the conversation, call toll-free in the United States and Canada, 1-800-642-1234. Elsewhere, drop us an email, hereonearth@wpr.org. Leave your phone number and we'll call you back. You can also post your thoughts at our web forum or leave a message at my blog. We're Radio Without Borders, here on Earth, from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Women, as in all parts of life, when there are conflicts, women are there. And the more they are acknowledged and included in the peace process, then the peace process will be more effective and will hold longer. Women are actors in life. They are not subjects.
That's Alma Almad Ali, who works on development projects in her home country of Sudan, talking about the importance of women in the peace process. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. I'm Jean Faraca. This hour, The Other Side of War. Stories of survival and hope, gathered by our guest this hour, Zainab Salbi, who is the founder of Women, Helping Women International, Women for Women International. And Zainab, before we get too late in the program, I really want you to tell us the story of Beatrice, the woman in Rwanda who perhaps has one of the most horrific stories to tell and one of the most astonishing comebacks. Can you tell us about Beatrice?
There are many Beatrices I know in Rwanda. I'll tell two stories. There are two Beatrices particularly. One of them is actually, I mentioned her in my introduction, which is a woman who was caught in a church, and seven of her children died on top of her in the massacre. And the only reason she survived because her children's bodies covered hers, and they thought that the militia said that she's dead. And she eventually, a few days later, she was able to leave the church, escape. She was caught again, raped. Again, they tried to kill her, and she simply survived. Now, I can stop the story here and just view Beatrice as a victim.
No. We won't let you do that.
No. I don't want to stop the story. Or I can continue it and talk about what Beatrice has done. And when I met Beatrice, she had adopted 5 children. She had kept the child that she had as a result of rape. She was sending them all to school. She had a small hut for them, and she was farming and making a living by sending them, and that's how she was sending them to school. But most amazing of it is that when I sat in front of her, she had a beautiful, big smile and saying, "Thank you for listening to me." And it was, I didn't see the thank you as for me personally, but as in the process of listening.
Mm-hmm.
And the process of how, and the reason I said we can stop the story there, because we often, when we talk about women in war, we talk about them as women victims, or rather we corner them into the victim stage. And the fact, the reality is, yes, they are victimized by war, but yes, they continue on and they move on, and they have an incredible courage and resilience to do what Beatrice has done in terms of adopting the children and keeping life going and not giving up.
And
that resilience, I feel, is the most amazing thing that we really need to acknowledge, because without strong women, we really cannot build strong countries in post-conflicts particularly.
And Beatrice is not an exception. In the country of Rwanda, the reason why I wanted you to focus on Beatrice is because she represents women actively involved in the peace process and rebuilding their country, women who did survive the genocide, who looked around and saw that the number of orphans could not possibly have been dealt with by the number of orphanages. And so they organized and found ways of integrating those orphans into family life. And women like Beatrice adopted the orphans and took them on as a replacement family for the children she herself lost in the genocide.
Absolutely. And solved the national crisis in that way, actually. They were no, as you said, there were 500,000 orphans in Rwanda and not many orphanages. And the women, there was an appeal for women to solve this, what was a national crisis. A little bit more than 10 years later after the genocide in Rwanda, 50% right now in Rwanda today of the Rwandese parliament are women. 50% of their ministers are women. 50% of their Supreme Court judges are women, headed by a Supreme Court judge who is a woman. And their accomplishments in terms of really taking on the leadership and rebuilding their country really is credited to women in Rwanda. And this is acknowledged by everyone, including their own president, who says, I need women to rebuild the country. I couldn't do it without women being fully involved in the rebuilding of the country. So rather than taking women as a marginal issue, we really need to look at the women as major issue, as a major contributor to really building peace and security in the countries. We often find women missing from the negotiating tables. And women's rights are the first thing that gets negotiated away by the negotiators, whether they are secular or religious groups. And trust me on that, it's historically been negotiated away in exchange for economic deals and borders and things like that. But when we believe that women are indicated for the direction of the society, the protection of women's rights becomes a national interest, and not only for the interest of women, but it's a national interest to protect it, because when women progress, they take the whole family and the whole society up with them. And when the women retreat back home, they also take the whole society back with them.
We have Carla joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Carla. Go ahead.
Hi. Certainly I'm enjoying the most recent comments, but to go back a little bit, you were talking about life for civilians in Iraq post-Saddam and during his regime. And, of course, I believe, you know, that Saddam Hussein was a very bad man who did bad things and heinous crimes. But as an American mother and a civilian, you know, I have great empathy and wonder if what we have done has done any good for the children and the women of Iraq. And I'm wondering, obviously, short term, since there's not a lot in place right now that is doing the social services that you mentioned, such as, you know, get them the food, get them the electricity, get them the jobs, the water, the health care, what could we do as American mothers to help influence some change in that regard?
Good question. Thank you, Carla.
Very good question. And I hope that you don't take my previous as a defense of what we have done, because I'm not in defense of it whatsoever. This is how do we do change within countries that is sustainable, and for any change to be sustainable, it needs to come from within and not from outside. Having said that, we are now in a mess in Iraq, and whenever I talk to any Iraqi in Iraq, the first line they say is security is really bad. The second sentence they say is life is so expensive and no one is talking about how we actually can live. For example, a price of a kerosene unit in Iraq right now, which everyone depends on, every single household depends on for cooking and heating, used to be $1 a unit, now it is $20 a unit. And there are no jobs except to join the army and the police. So what can you do as an individual? I would say sponsor a woman through Women for Women International in Iraq help her out there.
How do we do that?
Go to our website, www.womenforwomen.org. Help one Iraqi woman. At least you will be helping one family. What can you do as a citizen of this country? I would say the urge here is to divert money towards economic development, towards reconstruction, towards building schools and hospitals and restoring the electricity. And that would be, in my opinion, would be a major way to build peace and security in Iraq for Iraqi's sake and for America's national interest. We need to invest in the economic development and in getting tangible deliveries for the people there. Otherwise, the country is destroyed, and we need to keep hope alive. Once hope is destroyed, and that's the thing, the concept that keeps a society glued together, then we lose it forever. And I'm not saying that only as an Iraqi, but as a women's rights activist, as someone who works with women survivors of wars, we cannot leave them alone. They are struggling out there. They really are desperate, and we need to reach out to them, and we need to give tangible deliveries to them. And that is not food, but that's actually enabling them to create their own income and being there for them and help them rebuild their country.
In one of the ironies of what you're telling us is that apparently all of the efforts to rebuild the infrastructure have been stymied by the insurgency, which destroys as soon as it's rebuilt. And so the dilemma is how to get through that.
Well, the insurgents are fighting by making people's lives miserable. We need to fight by making people's lives good, and not only by actual fighting with weapons, but we need to fight by making people, and that's how we win, when one can win the hearts and minds of people. And unless we address that, in my opinion, then there's a disconnect between the reality on the ground and the reality of the discussion in here. But the discussion about Iraq is very much limited to what I call the frontline discussion. It's the troops, it's the weapons, it's the borders, it's things like that. And we've got to address the backline discussion, which is the discussion on life, on food, on electricity, on education, on fear, on love, on all of these feelings that people go through. These are the long-term impact on the society, and we need to address the backline discussion to talk about how we build peace in Iraq.
We're at 1-800-642-1234. And is the situation in Iraq different, would you say, from the other conflict zones where Women for Women International has been so effective?
The difference in Iraq is non-profit organizations have been also targeted. Charity workers, employees who are really helping to just stabilize people's lives who are not political have been targeted for kidnapping and killing and assassinations and things like that. And it makes our work so, so dangerous, and that's why so many groups have left. And other organizations, because we work also in Congo, which is a very, very dangerous country in terms of the fightings, and in Sudan, in southern Sudan, not only Darfur, but in southern Sudan, which also there's been so much, the complete destruction of infrastructure. NGOs, non-profit organizations, aid workers are not usually targeted. We are usually left alone to deliver the service deliveries. And the difference in Iraq is that we are targeted because, again, it's a destruction. The target here is anybody to stabilize lives over there. And that's the biggest challenge.
What has been, when you put together the stories in The Other Side of War, which are the stories that are most memorable to you? Which are the stories that you return to when you are looking for hope?
Many. I actually remember a Sudanese woman, and I'm not sure it's the story about hope, but really a story of courage and resilience, maybe even more. A Sudanese woman that I met who had only a skirt on and a bra, and I was sort of surprised, why is she, you know, not wearing a shirt or whatever? And I went and talked to her, and she explained to me that she was walking for 1 month. When the rebels attacked her village, she put all her clothes, one on top of each other, and wore them all, and took her two children and walked for a month. And every time she crossed a river, or she needed to cross a river and needed a boat ride, she would sell one item. And every time she needed to feed her children, she would sell another item of her clothes. And by the time she reached to the safe haven where I met her at, she literally, literally only had her bra and skirt on. And And for me, it's a story that's really touching because it's just of resilience. The other story is of a Bosnian woman who, it was actually in her 70s, and when the Serbian army attacked her village, her husband and her were running away from their homes to the forest. He fell and he broke his glasses and he could not see. And he told her to go and run away and save her life, and she refused. And she carried him on her back the whole night until they went to the neighboring village and they were safe. And that's, again, the incredible story of courage. The story of hope,
I was in Colombia with one of the photographers in the book, Susan Maizales, and we went to a village where we work is in the area. There was a lot of fighting between the FARC, the paramilitary, and the government, and very tense area, very insecure area. And we were crossing a river to go to a village, and we met a woman who crossed the river on her own, an older woman with her walking stick. And she was telling us that she walks 2 hours to go to our training each day. And I was shocked. I was actually really shocked that someone would walk 2 hours to go for a training, because I didn't even know if I can drive for 2 hours to go to school. And she said, I said, so why would you do that? She said, but it's knowledge. And no one, not many groups, there isn't much opportunities, rather, for knowledge. So when we have it, we grab it, and we really try to do whatever we can do with it.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you one question before we run out of time. You mentioned in the introduction to The Other Side of War that the pattern in the past has been that when women come to the fore, as they did in World War II in this country with Rosie the Riveter, at the end of the war, they recede into the background again. Do you find any reason to believe that that pattern is changing?
That patterns only change if there is a societal acknowledgement that we need women to stick around and not to go back. And in that, when it happened in countries like Rwanda, where 70% of the population were women. And there was no way to even clean the streets from the bodies that were killed in the genocide without women contributing to that process. So the society needed them. It happens when women organize, but I think women always are good in organizing, and that's never an issue. But the main reason why it happens is leadership commitment. And in the case of Rwanda, the president of Rwanda is personally committed to promoting women because he feels he needed them. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to women's issues, I don't believe this is about the global south vis-a-vis the north in terms of someone having more rights than the other. When it comes to women's issues, no matter where we are, what our religions or ethnic groups or countries or whatever, women always have similar issues to deal with. In the fact that domestic violence, that rape still a major issue, in the fact that they are discriminated against, in the fact that our voices are not heard strongly enough. And that we really need to be heard. And that entails leadership commitment from us, but also from the leaders to get women's voices heard for the larger national sake.
Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
It is my pleasure. Thank you.
Zeynep Salbee, the author of The Other Side of War, Women's Stories of Survival and Hope. You'll find a link to Women for Women International and to Zeynep Salbee's blog when you visit hereonearth.org. And for a copy of today's program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 28K. Here on Earth was produced this hour by Joe Hartke, Carmen Jackson, Lisa Nett, and Steve Williams, with the cooperation of the Division of International Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, international.wisc.edu. I'm Jean Faraca. Thanks for listening.